And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's been 8 months since Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast, displacing hundreds of thousands of people and destroying the legendary spirit of New Orleans. But it has been 8 months, and by now, things are beginning to return. But not many are saying returning to normal. We talk with two people who have been there, one doing research on the remnants of the sludge that became concentrated on virtually everything, and another who fled the flooding and now is back. It's a special report on post-Katrina New Orleans when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
New Orleans braces for a catastrophic blow from Hurricane Katrina overnight, as forecasters predict that this Category 5 storm could drive a wall of water over the city's levees. The huge storm, packing 160 mile-per-hour winds, is expected to hit the North Gulf Coast in the next 9 hours and make landfall as a Category 4 or 5 hurricane Monday morning. The National Hurricane Center reports that conditions are already deteriorating along the central and northeastern coast. New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin declared a state of emergency Sunday and ordered a mandatory evacuation of the city. "This is a threat that we've never faced before," Nagin said. "If we galvanize and gather around each other, I'm sure we will get through this." Nagin estimated that nearly 1 million people had fled the city and its surrounding parishes by Sunday night. Between 20 and 25,000 others who remained in the city lined up to take shelter in the Louisiana Superdome, lining up for what authorities warned would be an unpleasant day and a half minimum. That's how it came to us. August 28, 2005. 8 months later, with at least 1,300 deaths and epic destruction of an American refuge that attracted crowds of people who like to live a bit beyond the normal boundaries, there has been very little good news about the return of life to New Orleans. Today, we visit New Orleans to get two first-hand perspectives on how things are progressing. Last time we talked with Daryl Malik Wiley of the Sierra Club, he was talking to us from outside his hometown of New Orleans, not knowing if his house was standing or what his future might embrace. He joins us in segments 1 and 2, now that he's back in the city, trying to make sense of a very complicated situation. And in segment 3, we talk with Dr. Gina Solomon, who works with the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC, as she reports on the situation on the ground, literally, and on the walls as the toxic sludge that covered much of the city for weeks dried up and left some nearly insurmountable challenges for those who must now face rebuilding their lives in New Orleans or their lives somewhere else. It's information you need to know. So, as this is a special edition of the Wild Side News, we begin the show as always with the news, then move on to our special field reports. So first, the news. As gasoline prices exploded, so too the reactions by many Americans who find the mundane responsibilities of going to work or running kids around to school becoming unaffordable. With his popularity plummeting to record levels, President Bush this week outlined his plans for combating the staggering price of gasoline.
First thing is to make sure that the American consumers are treated fairly at the gas pump. Americans understand, by and large, that the price of crude oil is going up and that the prices are going up, but what they don't want and will not accept is manipulation of the market. And neither will I. Federal Trade Commission is investigating whether the price of gasoline has been unfairly manipulated in any way. I'm also directing the Department of Justice to work with the FTC and the Energy Department to conduct inquiries into illegal manipulation or cheating related to the current gasoline prices. The FTC and the Attorney General are contacting 50 state attorney generals to offer technical assistance to urge them to investigate possible illegal price manipulation within their jurisdictions. In other words, this administration is not going to tolerate manipulation. Second part of a good plan is to confront high gasoline prices is to promote greater fuel efficiency. And the easiest way to promote fuel efficiency is to encourage drivers to purchase highly efficient hybrid or clean diesel vehicles, which, by the way, can run on alternative energy sources. Third part of the plan to confront high gas prices is to boost our supplies of crude oil and gasoline. It makes sense. We're in a supply and demand world. If prices are high, it means demand is greater than supply. One way to ease prices is to increase supply. One immediate way we can signal to people we're serious about increasing supply is to stop making purchases or deposits to the Strategic Petroleum Reserve for a short period of time.
Critics point out that although the president was beginning to understand that real alternatives are becoming imperative, albeit a few years too late, nevertheless, the changes outlined could make a difference in gasoline prices, although not in the near future. The president also, over the weekend, made a startling announcement that hydrogen was the fuel of the future. To which I say, then, Mr. President, let's get on with putting Americans to the task of creating the hydrogen future in the next 5 years. Over the past week and a half, two reports of humans being attacked by wild black bears are generating a lot of media frenzy about bears. To find out what we need to understand about bears and humans, we go to the source now. You're heading out to find a bear, is that right?
Yeah.
And you got a group with you?
Yes.
What, a school group or something, or what?
There are people from various parts of the country, part of the Black Bear Course.
You study bears. You work with bears. You're trying to educate people about bears. And as a matter of fact, you're on the way to find a bear, to track down a bear with a radio collar. What in the world are you doing?
What we're studying is bear conservation in their increasingly urbanized environment.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
We're learning what makes nuisance bears and how can people better coexist with bears.
That is a challenge because we're stepping on each other a bit more than we used to.
Yes. Yeah, people are moving into bear country like never before. As baby boomers get to the age where they have discretionary income and the technology generation is establishing home offices in the forest, working by email and fax, a huge move into the forest.
Where are you calling from?
20 miles from Ely, Minnesota, in northeastern Minnesota.
Well, that's wild country up there.
Absolutely.
As you say, I bet it's becoming a little more suburbanized or something like that.
Yeah, all the lakes are being developed.
Wow. Well, part of the thing that's generating this this conversation is the fact that, strangely enough, over the last week and a half or so, there have been two attacks by black bears on humans. And,
yes.
Of course, then all of a sudden, the next thing you know, everybody's out there telling people they shouldn't go to the woods and shouldn't take a hike and shouldn't do this and shouldn't do that because they might get mauled by a bear. What do you think is going on?
Thank goodness these kind of things are rare. I mean, okay, two attempts like that or one successful happened in a short period of time here. But overall, black bears have killed 57 people in the last 100 years across North America. And to put that into perspective, for each person killed by a black bear, there's like 13 killed by snakes, 45 killed by dogs.
Mm-hmm.
There's about 120 killed by bees, and about 240 killed by lightning, and about 60,000 homicides for each person killed by a black bear.
Right. It does help to use those numbers. Well, you're a guy who spends time with bears. Tell us about bears.
I started out, and for my first 20 years of research, I had a great fear of bears because I grew up with the same brainwashing that everybody else does. I read the outdoor magazines and saw the ferocious covers. I went to museums and saw bears mounted with this unnatural snarl on their face that I've never seen in the wild. and I'd go to national parks, and I'd get handed warning literature that I did not realize was generally written by attorneys to avoid what they perceived as liability problems. It took me a long time thinking bears are unpredictable and ferocious, looking for somebody to get. And when I would see any blustery, threatening-looking behavior on bears, I thought, yep, I know what you're trying to tell me, and I'm out of here. It took me a long time to realize that that is expressions, usually just ritualized displays of the bear's own nervousness. And when I began to interpret their behavior in terms of their fear rather than my fear, I was starting to get it right, and eventually I was able to get the confidence of wild bears to the extent that I could put collars, radio collars, on the bears without using tranquilizers, and that led to me being able to walk with them, sleep with them 24 hours at a time. And now my graduate student, Sue Mansfield, does the same. Mothers of cubs, doesn't make any difference, and I've never had a problem.
Well, now, what's that process of quote-unquote befriending a bear, a wild bear? We're talking about wild bears, and of course we always have to put that caution that this is something being conducted by people who are knowledgeable, have real experience, understand bear behaviors and communication, and therefore, when you're out there, you have an idea of what's going on. You don't want to walk up to a wild bear and just start doing silly things, because that could definitely get you in trouble.
In fact, it'd be extremely difficult to do that with a wild bear, because the first hurdle to overcome is to have them not run away from you,
mm-hmm.
and that's what you generally see. The bears that become killers, like is in the news now, the one that killed the 6-year-old girl, that's one black bear out of a million. I say that because there's about 750,000 in North America, less than one death per year, 57 in 100 years, and that comes out to one in over a million.
And that's really important to keep in perspective. That's almost nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, for the person who's unfortunately is attacked, it's everything. I'm with you. It fascinates me how animals and humans actually learn to cohabit. For example, I spent a couple of summers up in Yellowstone, and talk about interaction of people and animals and wildlife. This was grizzly bears and black bears, every kind of conceivable animal, and somehow they managed to get along. But tell us now, as you're really studying this interaction of people and bears, what are you finding out? What should people know?
Well, they're not the ferocious animals we once thought they were. And as what helped me to get over my fear was learning their language.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
And they communicate basically on three levels of intensity. The lowest level is their grunts and tongue clicks. Those are the amiable sounds they make towards each other. Mothers make the grunts to their cubs. Tongue clicks means they want to join another bear for friendly purposes. And then the next higher level is when they, often with some body language, like lunging towards a person and slamming down their feet and blowing explosively, that's the vocalization, blowing sounds mean the bear is nervous. And when I see any bluster, I feel safe, because it means they want to talk about it. I've never seen a bear show bluster and then attack.
Now
it means they're basically afraid.
Now, how do you respond to that behavior?
I basically ignore it. One of the big misconceptions about black bears is the idea of never get between a mother and her cubs.
Right.
And that's a grizzly bear trait. 70% of the killings by grizzly bears are by mothers defending their cubs, but I don't know of anyone who has ever been killed by a mother black bear defending her cubs. In fact, on this project, if I see a family group beside the road, I just hit the brakes, run after them. They flee, usually the mother in the lead, and they go to the nearest big tree. If I'm close enough behind them, I can grab the cubs off the side of the tree. They're in my hands screaming.
Mm-hmm.
That makes the mother upset. I expect a bluff charge, but I've never been touched.
Mm.
They're just not ferocious animals that we've been led to believe by the outdoor magazines, the taxidermy, and all the warnings we see.
Well, what's a safe way to, and of course all of these are qualified, but what's a, as humans and bears come into closer proximity, we're finding them in our backyards, in our front yards, in our houses, and everywhere else. You know, what is the best way to try to what's the vision here of how to cohabit with bears? Because I'm with you. I think there's actually capabilities of getting along with these creatures to some extent.
Well, whether something is a problem or not depends on the person's attitude. If a person sees a bear going through their yard, to some people, that's a major problem. To others, it's the joy of their day. As we mentioned, you know, everybody's been moving into bear country, and the attitude of these people is going to determine the future of the bears that live around them. If their attitude is they're going to do what they want with their garbage, and if a bear comes to eat it, they'll shoot the bear, then their impact on the land is as large as the amount of land it takes to produce that bear. But if they're moving into bear country because they like wildlife and seeing a bear is a pleasure, well, then their impact on the land is no bigger than maybe the size of their yard, which is insignificant.
Mm-hmm. Now, if for example, let's say that you come home and in the backyard is your bear and he happens to be trying to tear into something. Let's say he's smelled something in your garage or something, and they can tear through things. What's the best way to try to stop that behavior?
Well, I would just be aggressive towards the bear and pepper spray. If anybody feels uncomfortable walking in bear country, pepper spray can be the great equalizer. That can make you king of the forest because it works as well on bears as it does on dogs. Mm-hmm. They don't go away mad, they just go away.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, I've been in the woods myself walking along and have a bear and cubs and myself have kind of startled each other. We somehow managed not to know that we were going to run into each other.
Yeah.
In a situation like that, they have their behaviors. What are human behaviors that will communicate to that bear that there is no harm intended, and the fact that we can just kind of get along with each other and not get along. I'm not trying to suggest that we should sit down and have a talk, but I mean to say that we're just there is no aggression intended.
I get asked that question a lot, and I've read all the warnings that are out there. I've got a huge file of warnings. It gets down to basically it doesn't make much difference what you do. Because all the warnings suggest that if you don't do it that way, you're going to be attacked.
Good point.
Truth is that you're not. You hear, speak softly and back slowly away. And I like that because it shows respect for the bear. And if a bear is there, it would want more space, so that's a nice thing to do. And then you hear, whatever you do, don't run because it could trigger a predatory response. But the truth is, just about the most common story I hear is, I saw a bear, I ran one way, the bear ran the other. And I don't know of any instance, and I've asked many of the people who write these warnings about, you know, don't run because you might trigger a predatory response, do you know of any instance where this has ever happened? And I've yet to come up with the first instance.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing you hear is, don't look the bear in the eye. They could think of that as antagonistic and attack. Not true. That's somebody sitting behind a desk extrapolating what they think about dogs.
Well, I think we learned that from Davy Crockett.
Oh, okay. Stare down a bear?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, we already knew that one then, didn't we?
Yeah, exactly.
And then people say, well, if a bear was close to me, I would be attacked because the bear would sense my fear. Well, that's something conjured up out of a person's own mind. They're afraid that the bear would attack, and that's what they perceive that the bear is out there looking for somebody vulnerable that they could attack. The bears are not looking for somebody to attack. 999,000, you know, except for the one out of a million. The truth is, just about everybody who finds themselves near a wild bear is afraid. And they're not attacked.
Actually, bears have a rather interesting diet. They're not really stalking and killing as much as people might think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, basically vegetarian, eating a lot of fruit, nuts, insects. They're not very good predators. They're not built for predation.
Mm-hmm.
They have these blocky bodies that are built for retaining heat in the winter, built for strength, bending branches and turning over stones. But not agile like a wolf or a cat for catching prey. They have more of a mind of a prey animal than that of a predator, and I think that comes from their living for hundreds of thousands of years right here in North America alongside such powerful predators as saber-toothed cats, American lions, dire wolves, and the giant short-faced bear. Black bears wouldn't have stood a chance against any of these predators, but they were the only one of them that could climb trees.
Mm-hmm.
And so they survived by staying near trees and developing the attitude of run first, ask questions later. And you could ask any hound hunter today, he'll tell you he can chase the biggest black bear with his littlest hound.
That's interesting. Now, you spend time, real time, with bears. At any particular time, how many bears are in your region that you're tracking and paying attention to?
Oh, there's probably one per square mile, and we're studying how these bears coexist so well with the rural community here scattered through the woods, so well that there has never been a complaint of nuisance behavior officially lodged, which is really noteworthy. If people want to really learn more about bears, this black bear course that we have here at the Wildlife Research Institute in Ely, they can find out more about it on the web at www.bearstudy.org and click on Black Bear Course. What we're heading out now is there's eight of us heading out into the woods to home in on a radio-collared bear that has become accustomed to having people walk with it. It's a mother with cubs. My grad student, Sue Mansfield, walks with this bear every day. And we're going to join this bear and just watch how they live. There's two nonprofit organizations here, the Wildlife Research Institute for Bear Research, and then the North American Bear Center, which will open in May 2007. And that has an award-winning top educational site about bears, www.bear.org. And that is an organization that right now is looking for people to put their names onto exhibits that we're going to have, educational exhibits about bears.
One more detail. What's it like? What's the weather like up there in Ely right now?
It's beautiful right now. It's probably 63 degrees with partly cloudy sky and calm wind. The grass is coming up, and some of the forest plants, at least, are not in flower yet, but coming up,
yeah.
And that's providing the main food for bears right now.
Okay. Well, listen, if by chance you actually come in contact with that bear that you're trying to track down with your radio collar, just give me a call.
Okay.
We're talking with Lynn Rogers, who's with the Wildlife Research Center in Ely, Minnesota, and as well as working on the North American Bear Center. Perhaps we'll hear from you shortly. Thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you.
And for the first time in months, we managed to get through a newscast without having to report on some kind of devastating weather event. So enjoy the nice weather while we've got it. And that's the news. This is a special edition of the Wild Side News as we take an in-depth look at efforts to do something with a disaster left by Hurricane Katrina 8 months ago. As every American is well aware, things have not gone well at any point in this saga. And as residents try to put their lives back together, they are buried in mounds of red tape, making the recovery from the mounds of broken homes, lives, and neighborhoods just that much worse. We talked with Daryl Malik Wiley, who based his work with the Sierra Club from New Orleans. When we last talked with Daryl, Katrina had swept into the city. He was driven out and gave us his assessment of the damage that wracked the coastal region. Well, he's back on the ground in New Orleans with a special perspective on the rebuilding, and we now shift our attention to New Orleans, where Daryl will bring us up to the minute on what's happening post-Katrina.
For those of us who are fortunate enough to not be affected by these devastating storms that seem to be wreaking havoc across America in various places, whether it's in Northern California or in the Midwest or in Tennessee, the East Coast has had their share, but of course, the storm of all storms is Katrina. Katrina stands alone in terms of its devastation and the capacity for the United States to effectively deal with this. It's a huge, huge, historic storm. Well, When the storm happened back in September of last year, I was fortunate enough to talk with someone who really has his feet on the ground in that area, because he works with the Sierra Club in Baton Rouge and New Orleans and throughout actually the entire coastal area. And at that particular time, he was away from his home and didn't really know what had happened to his home. Daryl Malik Wiley, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Glad to be with you, Sydney.
Well, what did happen, Daryl?
Well, so much that it's hard to put it all in just a few words. When last time we talked, I was in San Francisco for the big Sierra Club Summit and came back, flew back from San Francisco to Houston, where I originally evacuated, and then went back and stayed in Baton Rouge for 4.5 weeks. So I was out of my house for 6.5 weeks. I and my wife were one of the lucky ones in that our house did not flood, but there was they had a mandatory evacuation, so nobody was allowed in the city until early October. Through my work with the Sierra Club, I got a press pass for Sierra Club magazine and went into New Orleans about 2.5 weeks after the storm in September.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very chilling, surrealistic coming back to this very vibrant town that I left just 2.5 weeks before, and nobody there. Signs of flood water, you know, up on buildings. I came to my house, and there was a fluorescent yellow X painted on my house, and I later learned that every house had that fluorescent some color painting on it that signified who came by to look at the house, if they entered the house, what date they did it, and if they found any bodies. So that was very chilling, to say the least.
Yeah, that's right.
And then have sort of moved beyond that and just been extremely busy trying to talk about environmental issues related to Katrina, and there's loads of them.
Well, you really have a perspective, and I'd be just curious, this is your town, give the listeners a heads up on where you see things at right now in terms of this process. I mean, it's such a huge thing, but so give us whatever you want to talk about at this point.
Right. Myself, I think everybody watched the television right after the storm and saw all those images of really the inability, inaction of the federal government. And here we are 8 months later, and in some cases we still see that inaction by the federal government. FEMA has got so much red tape and different hoops that people have to jump through to try and get aid or trailers or support in moving back to the city. There have been plan A through Z, I think, so far. And every time you turn around, there's something new to really upset people as far as FEMA not being willing to pay for this, because it didn't happen by the storm, but yes, it was destroyed, but it was by the wind, and just all sorts of bureaucratic red tape. And the concern, I think, that a lot of folks in New Orleans have raised, they're talking about now in funding in the range of $18 to $20 billion, which seems like lots of money. I know if I had that much money, I'd probably not be worrying about being an environmental activist. but in the scope of things, that's just a drop in the bucket as to what's needed to make the city of New Orleans and Gulf Coast back normal. The people need to understand, all the flooding in the city of New Orleans was not caused by the hurricane. It was caused by flaws in the Corps of Engineers levee system that failed. So all of the flooding in New Orleans was preventable if the Corps of Engineers would have done its job properly in the past. And so, to my way of thinking, the federal government failed New Orleans residents, St. Bernard residents, by allowing this flooding to happen. Therefore, they should make everybody 100% whole again. And we're very far from that. They're talking about pennies on the dollar as far as property values on helping people get their lives back together. And then you add on top of that all the environmental insults, and it's just very frustrating, and lots of angry folks down here.
Well, I don't blame people. I mean, It's a huge disaster. I can't think of anything that compares in my lifetime to what happened. It's a city that's taken out. When you sort of visualize the city, how much of it would you say is really at this point dysfunctional?
Right, 80% of Metro New Orleans, Orleans Parish flooded, and of that, I'd say maybe 60% is still non-functional. There are large sections of town that if you go there at night, there aren't street lights. The Holy Cross neighborhood, which is part of the lower Ninth Ward, the Holy Cross Neighborhood Association I'm working with, people are not allowed to stay in their homes overnight because there's still a curfew in that area. And that's causing all sorts of problems because we're seeing not only the devastation by the flood, but we're seeing human greed coming into play. There's been a rash of architectural theft. You know, many homes in New Orleans are beautiful wood structures with lots of interesting architectural details, and there's almost been a systematic looting of some parts of towns where one day every fence, cast iron fence, will be gone, and the next day all the shutters are gone, and then windows, and it's with the Holy Cross neighborhood, it's especially hard because people aren't allowed to live there to watch over their property, and the police have not been protective enough of the area.
This special edition of the Wildside News returns following this short break.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
Seems everyone wants to ascribe blame for the disaster of New Orleans. Trouble is, blaming at this point only muddies the waters of hope for those who are trying to actually get things done. There is perhaps a huge lesson to be learned from this disaster, and as so many have said before, from the ashes of disaster, new opportunities are possible. Is that where we're headed in New Orleans? We find out when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wildside News. Daryl Malik Wiley was one of the luckier ones in New Orleans, if living in a moldering disaster zone can be considered lucky. But as with so many of us who care for our earth and the living systems, when our human populations are battered, that nature of caring quickly reaches out to our own. Well, now, people who have lost their, who cannot be in their homes, let's put it that way, who cannot be in their homes for whatever reason it is, and a lot of these people are, they're just folks. I mean, they don't have access to great big bank accounts, and they can't just go to their banker friend and say, hey, boy, tough luck for me, but write me a loan. And yet the cost of rebuilding or recreating their home must be almost impossible. What are those people supposed to do, just give up?
Well, I think some folks would like people just to give up because there have been a number of developers that have visions for what they want New Orleans to look like.
See, but that bothers me.
It bothers me extremely because their vision has less diversity than what New Orleans had before the storm.
Well, not only that, but it seems to be an unfair taking by people who are advantaged. And that just, to me, it rankles me. I don't oftentimes really get all that carried away on this show. I try to maintain my relative balance and sense of fairness. But I'll tell you, to be honest with you, I just think this is totally unfair. It's not what should be happening in America. But people lose their homes, somehow they should have the right to get that home back.
That's exactly true, and it's been very frustrating to us here in New Orleans because most of the decisions about the recovery are being made in Congress. And Louisiana and Mississippi have very small delegations in Congress, and so we have to convince politicians in California, Utah, Idaho to spend money in Louisiana, and there's been a real reluctance to do that.
Yeah, wow. Well, it's going to be a long road back, and this is a difficult challenge. Well, we could go on more about that, the politics, et cetera, but we only have so much time.
Right.
And so, and we'll talk about this again, so because I so much appreciate your perspective. Talk about, since you were so involved with the Sierra Club,
yes.
You bring a unique, a truly unique perspective to this recovery. What is it that you're really focusing on now?
Well, I'm focusing on working with the Holy Cross neighborhood and then a Vietnamese-American community in New Orleans East. And just this weekend, the Sierra Club and a number of other environmental and community groups held a green rebuilding exposition. And we had all sorts of vendors talking about when we're rebuilding our homes and houses, how to be more energy efficient, how to be more healthy with our building materials, how to, you know, really, a lot of the green ideals as far as green building, people are really interested in that in New Orleans, and it's across the economic spectrum. I've been meeting in the Holy Cross neighborhood, and the people bringing up the green alternatives are not myself, but it's everybody in the community who sees these green building techniques as a way to save money, to protect their health, and possibly make their home more sturdy in case another hurricane comes.
Well, talk to us what that means, green building techniques.
Well, it's a lot of different things. It's one, the idea that you build your house with as much sustainable materials as possible. You insulate it well to cut down on heat loss or heat gain. In New Orleans, a lot of the older houses were built sustainably. They had windows that would open so you get a breeze through during the day. They had shutters that you could close and so the sun wouldn't come right in the house. They had 12-foot ceilings. So the heat would rise away from you. They were on pillars, so the air could go below you. So it's some of it's relearning the old architectural styles that the, you know, many of the homes in New Orleans were built with. But then you add in the new things that are happening, solar hot water heaters, which are in New Orleans and South Louisiana, very cost effective, can be paid back in almost 2 years. Solar energy cells on roofs to produce their own electricity. Insulating houses so they're better. And then in the building materials, putting plaster instead of sheetrock and natural plasters that you can actually stain with different colors and you never have to paint again. Making sure your materials that you put in the house don't put off any kind of vapors that could be toxic to your health. So a whole wide range of green building and green thoughtfulness is coming about and thinking about how to rebuild New Orleans. And it's really exciting for me, who's been involved so heavily in environmental issues for 30 years, to see that not only mainstream has caught up, but they're pushing even harder to get more kind of things happening in New Orleans.
Typically, when you try to innovate,
right,
and bring in new strategies and techniques, right away you run into building codes and other problems. How's that being handled?
One thing that happened after the storm, the state legislature passed a statewide new building code. Until that happened last year, there was no building code in the state of Louisiana.
Hmm.
And as part of that, there is a whole section on energy efficiency that at one point was taken out, but the Sierra Club and architects were able to get put back in the bill. So we have sort of a basis in the building code for energy efficiency and some different things.
Mm-hmm.
We're still looking at doing additional changing and strengthening of the building code in New Orleans to bring in even more energy efficiency ideas, hurricane-resistant ideas. So it's an ongoing effort to move things forward.
Well, one thing we hear about is the concept of building the houses up off the ground, so
right.
many feet. How on the ground, literally, how are people responding to those concepts in terms of rebuilding?
Well, it depends on which parts of town you're in. Like in Holy Cross, most of the homes down there were built in the 1850s, 60s, 70s, and they were built 3 to 4 feet off the ground.
Hmm.
So they're already, you know, up like that, and we don't think there's going to have to be any additional moving them any higher than they are currently. We don't know if that's true because FEMA might change their mind.
Now, was that done with foundations or was it more on pilings?
It was done on piers.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, the houses are built on a series of brick piers, pillars, up about 3 feet. And you have a porch and then steps into the house.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
And that's some of the, you know, this is the traditional building method in New Orleans was putting things on piers like that because historically the river, Mississippi River, would flood the community. So you would want to have that little advantage so you wouldn't have to rebuild your house every year. What happened post-World War II in the building boom sort of those years, contractors pushed the city council to do more building houses on slab, mainly because it cost the builders a lot less money to do it that way, and they were thinking very short-term how they could make money, but not the long-term sustainable way.
Well, and of course, that's where we get into trouble.
That's usually where we get into trouble, yes.
Where we just kind of ignore the fact that nature will win.
Yes, yes. It's very interesting, well, you know, relearning a lot of things that we have forgot here in New Orleans historically. Because there was a tradition up the river from New Orleans, all the plantation homes and a lot of the houses on there were all built, they were designed so that the whole first floor could flood.
Hmm.
And you would have eating areas down there and things like that, but when you knew the river was going to flood in the spring, you'd move everything up to the second floor, and you just lived up there.
That is so amazing.
And the other thing that's happening that's really upsetting to me and lots of folks here is we have hundreds, if not thousands, of homes that are going to have to be torn down because of damage from the flood. And what we're seeing with FEMA, their mindset is so focused on, we've got to get the debris out of here, and the way we do that is get a bulldozer, crunch it up, put it in a truck, and bury it in the ground, which is, in my way of thinking, you know, 18th, 19th century thinking. Instead of really training teams to go in and deconstruct the homes, salvaging as much as possible, recycling as much as possible, and then you only have a little bit to go into landfills rather than a lot. And that's where it comes to the issue, the other issue I'm working on, near the Vietnamese-American community in New Orleans East. This community is the largest concentrated population of Vietnamese-American in the United States. They came back very soon after the storm and started rebuilding their community and did exactly what the mayor of New Orleans said. Think out of the box. Think creative. What do you want your community to look like? And they came up with this wonderful idea of creating a Viet town. And they brought in architects from all over the U.S. and some from Vietnam to design a town that was architecturally traditional to them in Vietnam and yet fit into South Louisiana.
Very interesting. It's
very interesting. Beautiful, interesting design, architectural styles, energy efficient. And then along comes the mayor of New Orleans, who, with an executive order, which had no input by the public, changed the zoning on a piece of property less than a mile from this neighborhood to allow a solid waste landfill to be put in. And it's a classic example of environmental racism. You put landfills, incinerators, anything you don't want in the community that has less political power. And so I've been working very actively with that community to try and change, to stop the landfill from going in, not only with litigation, but with all sorts of activities to stop the possible putting in the landfill. And it's frustrating because our state agency says it's going to be a, quote, temporary landfill. So I ask them, Well, what does that mean? And they said, well, temporary means it's going to take us a year to fill it up, and it'll be there forever. And I said, well, that doesn't sound real temporary to me, because they're talking about digging into the ground 35 feet below grade level and then piling trash up to grade level and then 75 feet above. So it'll be basically the highest spot in New Orleans will be this landfill. It'll be there forever, and we just think it's a real outrageous activity to put it in this neighborhood or any neighborhood when there are alternatives such as the deconstruction and other permitted landfills that the waste could go to.
Well, of course, no one wants landfills in their backyard.
Yep.
That's just the way it is.
Right.
There's problems. They smell, and there's traffic and all sorts of different things. But in this particular case, because of what is going into that landfill, it will be a concentrated toxic waste dump, not just a landfill.
That's correct, and that's of concern because everything that's in houses, you know, it's supposed to be a, quote, construction debris landfill, but they changed the definition of construction debris to be anything they pick up that was caused by Hurricane Katrina. It includes all the herbicides and pesticides that were in anybody's garage, all the cleaning products that were underneath the sink, you know, any pharmaceutical drugs, you know, so a whole range of things is all going to go into this hole, and the landfill is situated about 50 feet from a canal, and you cross that canal, and then you have Bayou Sauvage Wildlife Refuge. That canal also connects back to the Vietnamese community where they're using the water out of the canal to irrigate their gardens, where they have amazing agricultural practices of gardens, growing some of the similar things that they grew in Vietnam, since the climate in New Orleans and parts of South Vietnam are very similar.
Well, it sounds as if that particular community, the Vietnamese community, has really just charged in there and kind of applied native talents and skills and knowledge to bring their community back to life in a faster form.
Yes, it's been amazing to me working with this community and the leadership, and the main driver in the community is the church there, which is Mary Queen of Vietnam, a Catholic church. And it's sort of the center of the community, the hub focus. And I have met and becoming friends with the two ministers, Father Luke and Father Vin. And they said on weekends now they're having between 2,000 and 2,500 people at Mass on Sunday. And what's happening, they're not there all during the week, but they're coming in on weekends to work on their houses and then have to go back because there still are not schools available in that area. So it's exactly what the mayor said he wanted to happen, but then he's sort of penalizing them for doing what he said they wanted to happen. So it's just outrageous.
In terms of your work with that community,
right,
what are you focusing on?
Well, we're focusing on how we can change it. Yesterday, Sunday, they had a small meeting. Congressman Honda, who's actually represents San Jose, was there. He was in New Orleans as head of the Asiatic Caucus, I think it is what it's called. But he was visiting different Asiatic groups in throughout the hurricane zone to see what was going on. So he spoke a while, and we were able to inform him of what was going on, and he's going to check when he gets back to Washington on what he can do on his end. And then also Reverend Jesse Jackson came by the church and spoke, and he's going to get involved with helping the people to fight and struggle to make this not happen. So we're working on a range of things. One, legal options. We're looking at what lawsuits can be brought. Two, we're in the midst of a mayor's election. If Mayor Nagin is defeated, the next mayor can revoke the executive order. And we're seeing what else we can do. But it's a lot of education of the community, not only the Vietnamese-American community, but the greater community of New Orleans as to what's going on.
There's a lot of poor people that were in New Orleans.
Yep.
I'm just curious about their future. Are they going to be able to come back? It just seems like such a difficult problem because it comes down to money so often. And I feel sorry for folks who had their homes. They may have inherited them going back generations, and this was their place, and now that it's gone. Are there any means for these people to be able to... they own the land. That's what's interesting. I would have to assume they own the land, but the house on top of it's gone. What are their options these days?
Well, that's what we're trying to figure out, what their options are. Yes, they own the land. The government is putting together this package of relief, and the way the money travels, it comes from Washington to the state of Louisiana, and they're trying to set up a program that will go to the city and or the homeowners, and we're not sure how that's going to work yet. It's all sort of, there's been a lot of money promised, but nothing's gotten here yet.
Well, the sad part about it is people can only wait so long.
That's true.
Your life can only be on hold for so long before you finally say, you know what, I'm going to have to move on. That's not fair. You've mentioned the work in the Vietnamese community, but I'm curious about other kind of almost people-oriented attempts to have some control of their life and their destiny. I can imagine in most cases those are being overruled and trumped by regulations or lack of regulations, and so nothing's happening. But is there any opportunity for people to kind of take control of their life?
There is, and what the mayor of New Orleans has said from the very early, he wanted neighborhood groups to sort of plan how they wanted to come back, how they wanted to revision their community. So, and as part of that process, they were going to provide planners and other resource folks to the community to help them do this. Well, the sad fact is that has not happened yet. But the Holy Cross community decided, we're not going to wait. We're going to go ahead, and in fact, they've already had a number of meetings. We've been meeting weekly since December, thinking about how we're going to get back together, how the community is going to come back together, how to get back in touch with people. This coming week, we're going to have a two-day, Friday, Saturday, day-long sessions on re-envisioning what the community should look like, what kind of buildings we want there that were destroyed, and how to rebuild new. So it's really exciting to be involved with these types of groups and see the dynamic leadership coming from the grassroots up, not waiting for government to do anything. And we've been relatively blessed in that other people have sort of come forward and say, we'll help. And that's the University of Colorado School of Landscape Architecture came down and for a four-day period with 28 students and did some studies and looking at things. And they went back to the university, and they're coming back with ideas for the community. The University of Florida School of Architecture has sent a team in, and they're doing a different part of the project. And then we've gotten a grant the Department of Energy gave a grant to the Louisiana Department of Natural Resources to do workshops on energy-efficient rebuilding in Holy Cross. So it's been all sorts of things. And then the latest things just happened is Brad Pitt. I think everybody knows Brad. He's over in Africa right now. But he's has a very keen interest in architecture. And he has partnered with Global Green, which is a nonprofit, worldwide nonprofit, and they're going to have a architectural competition to come up with ideas and plans for new or rebuilding of houses in the Holy Cross neighborhood. So that's going to be happening, and that's real. It helps the community in that we're getting publicity outside of New Orleans that we are a viable working community, and we'll just see how things move forward.
There's been some different models of planned communities where you're trying to increase, for example, green zones and open spaces and communal spaces and more or less consolidating homes. Now, some people like that, some people don't. How are things sort of developing in terms of revisioning neighborhoods?
Right. Well, the Holy Cross neighborhood, like I said, was built in the 1850s, 60s, 70s, and then, you know, been added to different times since. So there is a grid pattern in the community. There are some open spaces. And what we're trying to look at is how to bring back, it's had a real lack of services. There isn't a grocery store. There's not restaurants. There, you know, lack of the usual services. So we've talked about how we can, there's one main highway or avenue, St. Claude Avenue. And that has sort of fallen in disrepair over the years. And so we're thinking about how we jumpstart that part of the community with some new architectural buildings to bring in, you know, grocery store, coffee shops, art galleries, neighborhood restaurants. So that's part of the revisioning. The other part is thinking about the houses that were built recently that don't really fit the character of the community and suffered damage, to deconstruct them and come back with something that's affordable for people to live in, and not gentrify the neighborhood, but keep the very rich diversity of culture in the neighborhood. And that's the main thing we want to make sure. When people hear the Lower Ninth Ward, they have these visions of all the houses blown away and from the floodwater. The Holy Cross, part of the Lower Ninth Ward, had floodwater, but it didn't. By the time the water got to the Holy Cross neighborhood, it was not the rush. So there was not the real physical damage. Mm-hmm. It was just more the damage from the water being there.
Mm-hmm.
And we're thinking about other ideas. There's an old warehouse along the river. We're thinking about how to convert that into a buying co-op, because there are 2,000 homes in the Holy Cross neighborhood, and we need 2,000 refrigerators, washing machines, hot water heaters. So we want to try and put together some kind of buying co-op and go to somebody and say, okay, we want 2,000 of all of these things. What kind of deal can you give us? And thereby cutting down the cost to everybody in the community for buying those appliances and making sure they're Energy Star compliant so that their ongoing energy bill stays down also. So those are some of the ideas we've come up with our revisioning process.
Well, it's a unique opportunity. There was a time when community was an important word. Communal was an important word. Cooperative.
Yep.
I have to assume that some of those words are suddenly mainstream within that community right now.
They are, and, you know, there's other words that are out there. Co-housing, that's sort of a new, you know, where you build a series of townhouses or small houses, but they all share, you know, a big kitchen in addition to their smaller kitchens, share a workshop, garage space, you know, so and really thinking about creative ideas on how the community can live and work together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really exciting to be here right now.
Well, that's a great spin on this thing. It's exciting to be here right now. That's good news. Amongst all of the difficulties that you folks have gone through, it's great to hear that type of spirit. And it is an opportunity. Quite honestly, we should just keep empowering this vision thing and this revisioning thing and really coming up with whole new strategies. This is a terrific opportunity for people to take a whole new way of looking at life in America. You know, we have this American ideal, which is single-family homes or multiple homes, but we have opportunities now to really rethink this, and perhaps this may be I think it really is an opportunity for some creative advancement in vision.
We think so, and that's what we're trying to say, is if we recreate New Orleans and the Gulf Coast of Mississippi in a more sustainable way, a greener way, we can be a showcase to the nation as to a different way to be about living in our communities. There has been a real lack of resources into urban centers for a number of years because certain powers that be are more in favor of suburban lifestyle, and I think that's a very non-sustainable lifestyle, and we're thinking about, you know, light rail and all range of different transportation opportunities. Bike paths, walking paths. And the city of New Orleans is very much designed historically for walking and easy getting around the community. So we're going back to some of our historic routes.
Mm-hmm. So as you look out within that community, are you seeing homes going back up? What's the level of reconstruction, redevelopment
right.
that's going on? Is it 5% or 10%? Is the community coming back?
Don't know right now. There are lots of folks back in. We're at the stage now where most of the folks have taken out the sheetrock, if they had sheetrock, and gutted their houses, but we're not in the stage yet of everybody building back. There are some folks in Holy Cross that have already been right at the head of the pack, and they've already got their house already re-sheetrocked, repainted, ready to move back in. They're just waiting on the city to allow them to come back. And there are different stages around the city.
And if a person gets it to that point, are some people just staying in their homes?
Yep.
Well, that would seem fair.
Some people are camping out in their houses, even though the city says you're not supposed to.
Mm-hmm. Anything else that you want to bring us up to date on that you think we need to know about?
I think that pretty much does it. As always, they can feel free to contact me by email. The Sierra Club webpage down here is louisiana.sierraclub.org. and we try and put stuff up there. And the main thing people should take away, they should write their congressperson and ask them what they're doing to help the Gulf Coast recover. And ask them, you know, why are you putting more money out of America for rebuilding than you are into America for rebuilding?
Well, and of course, with the situation with the global war on terror, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, there's huge challenges and, of course, therefore opportunities for us to rethink our future.
Yep.
Daryl Malik-Wiley with the Sierra Club down in the New Orleans and Baton Rouge area, I want to thank you so much and wish you great success as you try to rebuild your life.
Great. Thank you very much, Sydney. You take care.
Thanks.
The human spirit is perhaps the most indestructible force on Earth, and it drives us forward at times like these, often against such insurmountable obstacles. And as noble as that may be, this challenge has some uniquely complex layers that just may need attention before the serious re-emergence gains too much momentum. We learned about the cleanup, what's being done, what needs to be done, and how people are coping with the toxic remnants of disaster. When your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
We've all seen the pictures of the trapped people on the rooftops, the tangled masses of cars and strollers, boats and backyards left in the wake of the devil's deluge. What we may not have seen were the mass of chemicals from oil spills, trash dumps, garages, gas stations, and everything in between that mixed into the waters. And now the waters have gone. So where did all the toxic sludge go? We find out when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. This past week, the Natural Resources Defense Council released a report following months of research on the nature of the stuff left behind, the houses, walls, backyards, beaches, and everything that makes up a city like New Orleans. It's a challenge of astonishing consequence for generations to come. This week we're focusing on post-Katrina, which was such an extraordinary natural catastrophe that I think we kind of assumed it could never happen here, and it did. Secondly, we assumed somehow that we would be able to deal with this. This is America, and somehow the story seems to be that we're dropping the ball significantly. And there's another side to this story, which is the fact that in the effort to try to do something, perhaps people are being allowed back into New Orleans, and it may not be exactly the right thing to do. But we have to have some science to back this up, some facts, as I keep on hearing. And so joining us now from San Francisco is Dr. Gina Solomon. She is the senior scientist with NRDC, and she's also a clinical assistant professor at the University of California, San Francisco Medical School. Gina, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
First of all, give us a little background on NRDC. We hear these terms, and we kind of know what Natural Resources Defense Council, but what do you really do?
NRDC is a national nonprofit environmental advocacy organization. We go out there and identify threats to the environment and to the people living in the U.S. and around the world, and gather the scientific information that we need to quantify what's going on out there and then get something done about it. And sometimes that means trying to get laws changed. In some cases, it means getting regulations passed. And sometimes it means litigation, if necessary, against polluters or against the government if they're not protecting people.
Yeah, you do things that other people can't just because you have the power to do so, and that's an important part of protecting the public. One of your specializations is public health, very specifically. And so in that regard, you traveled to New Orleans to do some research on the status of particularly the environment that people are now facing heading back into. Why don't you talk about what brought this about, your concerns, and also when you went, and we'll kind of explore how you went about your research to start out with.
Yes, I'd be happy to tell you about it. In the immediate aftermath of the hurricane and flooding in New Orleans, we heard from our members that had been displaced from that area, and also from groups that we had worked with over the years that were based in communities down there, working on environmental issues and environmental justice issues. And they asked us to get down there and help them out because they wanted to know if there was a significant health risk from contamination in the floodwaters and the sediments that were left behind as the floodwaters receded. So we went down at the end of September last year for the first time and have gone down a number of times since then to do investigations, including scientific sampling of the air and of the muck that was left behind from the floods.
That was a tremendous concern. I know that I was following and covering that event on the Wildside News, and we heard these tales about the toxic soup that remained following the Katrina event, and that eventually, you know, the waters themselves were filled with all sorts of contaminants. That's one of the aspects of your research. That is to say, then what happened to all of those contaminants? Where did they go? What happened to them? What was the basis of these toxic chemicals? Where did they come from? And then how did this end up making its way into the sediments and the houses and virtually everything there?
When we went down there in late September, we saw evidence of leaking sewage lines, the smell of sewage and all kinds of appalling, rotting things. And also hundreds of thousands of flooded, destroyed vehicles, cars, trucks, plus gas stations and industrial facilities that had been flooded out. The result of all of this was raw sewage in the floodwaters that then got spread around in the muck, and a lot of petroleum hydrocarbons, gasoline, diesel exhaust, other industrial chemicals that were spread around in the flooding also. In addition, New Orleans has always had a problem with lead contamination in the soil, and this lead got picked up and moved around from area to area and spread on the surface. So stuff that might have been either in an industrial vat somewhere or under the surface of the grass or bushes was suddenly not only spread across people's front yards, but spread across the inside of people's home. And the kind of contact that people were in when they came back to their homes with this sort of sludge was very close. You know, people couldn't handle anything without coming in contact with it. And the tests indicated high levels of bacteria from the sewage, high levels of diesel chemicals, such as diesel fuel, and high levels of lead and arsenic. And when we found that out, we were trying to let people know that they needed to protect themselves and also that they needed to be careful, for example, about bringing their kids back into New Orleans until the problem was cleaned up.
Well, now, I haven't had a chance to visit New Orleans since Katrina, so I don't really have a visual on what it might be like to go into a home as a returning resident who goes into their home. what would they actually see? What would it look like? And how would they be able to easily identify, for example, the fact that this was radically contaminated?
Oh, Lord, looking in the homes that was flooded was enough to make you cry. First of all, as you approach the door of someone's home, you are hit with a powerful smell of mold. It was choking, and so it was clear that there was a problem. Then when you looked in, it really looked like the entire possessions of somebody's life had been put into a blender. Everything had been lifted up by the floodwaters, swirled around, and then dropped willy-nilly with the sofa on top of the television and the children's toys on top of the sofa and everything upside down and sideways, and everything covered with this sort of brownish-gray mud. And then the walls were covered with mold in all different colors, black mold, brown mold, green mold, that was almost hairy. It was fuzzy and growing off the walls. It was just sickening seeing what had happened to people's homes, because people were living there up until, right up until the day that the hurricane hit. And suddenly it was clearly no longer a place that anybody could live.
Well, it's the greatest catastrophe that I have witnessed personally in my lifetime. And it's hard to imagine how people are supposed to cope with this, but they have to. These were so many homes taken out, so many lives that were just so radically changed. And if it was my place, I definitely would want to go back there and salvage what I could and try to rebuild my life. And a lot of people are now currently doing that. And they're faced with this challenge. How does a person go about trying to clean this out? How in the world do you face such a catastrophe?
We saw people going back and encourage them to wear boots and gloves and coveralls over their regular clothing, and of course respirators to keep from inhaling that mold. And people were sorting painstakingly through their possessions to try to find what they could save, putting them in plastic bags to clean off later, and then having to carry all of their possessions out to the curbside and dump them for trash pickup. And then ultimately, these houses that were seriously mold affected had to be gutted completely, all the way down to the studs, because once the mold took hold, there was just no way to stop it. And initially, people were trying to just scrub the walls down with bleach because they heard that might work. We went in and did testing after people did that, and we still found sky-high levels of mold, and were able to inform people that it wasn't safe to just wipe down the walls with bleach. They really had to rip out the drywall and start again. The houses didn't have to be torn out completely, but the interior did, unfortunately.
Well, and I've built houses, and I know you start out with the studs, and you put on the drywall, but that water would easily contaminate even the studs, so even that had to be a problem.
Yes, people can, with hardwood studs, sand them down a bit and apply, for example, borax, which is, will sort of keep the mold from getting started again. Mm-hmm. So it is possible to deal with that kind of situation. The drywall, once it's wet, is just like a petri dish for mold, and there's no way to salvage that.
Well, so obviously people are back, and they're busy trying to salvage their lives. Do you think, to some extent, people are perhaps less aware than they ought to be about the dangers that perhaps people are, in the efforts of trying to rebuild their lives, putting themselves in a level of harm's way and subjecting themselves to dangers?
There have been conflicting signals coming out around the contaminants in the sediment. A lot of the government agencies, especially the state of Louisiana, has been putting out the message that the sediment is not seriously contaminated, that it isn't a problem and it doesn't need to be cleaned up. They've actually sort of disregarded their own standards for arsenic, lead, diesel fuel, and other contaminants. And disregarded high levels that at a normally at a hazardous waste site would have triggered an investigation and cleanup. And here this is in people's front yards. So it's been really difficult working with the state And also with some of the federal agencies, such as US EPA, because they're just trying to get people to go back and not worry about it. When we talk to some of these government officials behind the scenes, they'll say, oh, well, the contaminants were probably always there. Mm. And so, you know, it may not have been, you know, the lead levels and arsenic levels and diesel fuel levels may not have been safe before the hurricane, and they may not be so safe now, but there's not really any change. That's not an excuse. First of all, things are worse now than they were before. And second of all, things are spread across the surface. This gut, this muck is right on top of people's yards. It's right where kids will touch it. And then thirdly, once you know that there's a contamination problem, there's a moral responsibility to deal with it, to clean it up. Even if some of the lead did contaminate the soil of New Orleans before the hurricane, it's not safe for kids. Get it out of there now before people move back in. It's the best time to do the cleanup.
Well, for example, just to put this into perspective, in California here, and around, actually around the country, it used to be common if you changed the oil on a vehicle, a car, a truck, you'd take it someplace, you'd dump it on the dirt, you'd find some, you know, backyard area or some other spot and just dump it. And it became obvious, this is totally illegal now, and there'll be serious fines if anyone were to so much as dump a quart of oil on the ground here, because it gets down into water tables and begins to really destroy things. So it's hard for me to imagine how in the world you could take this toxic sludge that virtually will settle down onto every single square millimeter of ground surface and somehow assume that it hasn't created some sort of dramatic change.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, we're not talking about just the quart of oil that you might take out of your car here and that you'd be fined for if you dumped it. We're talking about millions, literally millions of gallons of oil that were spilled from a large refinery, the Murphy Oil Refinery, where there was a major leak, from numerous industrial facilities, gas stations, trucks and cars. And this stuff is now all across the surface of the soil and getting down into the groundwater table where it's going to bubble along under the houses and then come up when it rains again. So there's a long-term health concern here. The problem, of course, is that we do want New Orleans to be habitable again. We do want people to go back. We want them to go back to a place that's safe.
Talk about some of the specific toxins that you discovered. You don't have to be scientific about their levels because people can do their own research on that. You have those things, some of that information posted on the NRDC site. But talk about the effects that some of these specific toxins could have on people's health.
The kinds of toxins that we encountered vary in their effects quite a bit. For example, in the immediate aftermath of the flooding, when there were really high levels of sewage-related bacteria, people were getting very sick from it. We heard many reports of people with terrible skin infections requiring antibiotic treatment. If people got a cut and it got in contact with the floodwaters, they would get terrible infections. In some cases, people got serious vomiting and diarrhea, gastrointestinal problems, respiratory complaints. And then the other kinds of chemicals that we're talking about, the longer-term contaminants like arsenic and lead, we're not talking about short-term health effects that will hit people immediately, but rather long-term risks as kids move back into those areas, play, run around, and get in contact with this day in, day out. Arsenic is known to cause cancer in humans. There's no debate about that. And so that's not good for kids living in those communities. Lead, of course, is known to cause neurologic deficits and delays in children. And the diesel fuel contaminants are both possibly cancer-causing and also irritants to the skin and neurologic toxins. And then, of course, I haven't even talked about the mold. But those levels of mold in the air can be very serious.
Let's talk about that, because mold it seems some sort of harmless. It's some sort of coloration on the walls, and you kind of look at that, but mold, for some people, is very, for many people, quite honestly, it can be very serious in many different ways.
I haven't worked in the past a whole lot on mold, and it's, you know, one of those things I've never taken as seriously as I should have. But when I went down to New Orleans the first time in late September, when I walked down the middle of the street, I could smell that characteristic musty sort of smell of an old moldy basement. The whole city smelled like that. And then when I looked into the homes and saw the mold growing on the walls, I thought, oh, dear, there's a real problem here. So I've been working with some of the country's best mold experts over the past few months and have learned an awful lot about this stuff. And it really is hazardous, especially when you start talking about the high, high levels of mold spores in the air that we see in a place like New Orleans.
Are all people affected by some level of mold, and then as well, is there an increasing intolerance amongst certain populations?
It's tough to say what level of mold will hit people because there is a lot of variation in sensitivity in the population.
So it varies quite a bit amongst individuals.
Absolutely. Mold is a tricky thing because, you know, if you hit really high levels of mold spores in the air, anybody will eventually develop some symptoms because it catches in your throat, it makes you cough, and you get this sort of irritation in the back of your nose and your sinuses. I'm not particularly sensitive to mold, but after spending time in New Orleans in the flooded areas, even though I was wearing a respirator a lot of the time, I found I was coughing and my nose was running and I was stuffy. Other people who were sensitive were very sick. People can be allergic to mold, just like they're allergic to pollen or dogs or cats or dust mites. And for someone who's allergic to mold, even low levels can cause severe allergic reactions or asthma attacks.
Mm-hmm.
And so asthmatics coming back into the city were very high risk of serious breathing problems. In addition, people who are prone to sinus problems will certainly have, you know, develop a sinus infection and a flare-up of their sinus problems. People who have underlying respiratory disease often get worse in the presence of mold. And then there's the whole set of sort of controversial effects of mold related to the toxins that mold, some kinds of mold, produce. And when we measured the molds in New Orleans, we found quite a few that produce so-called mycotoxins or mold toxins.
I know for myself, I didn't know that I was extremely sensitive to certain molds, but I moved to La Jolla, rented a little apartment, and within 2 days, I was so sick that I had no idea. I thought I had the flu, but I could hardly think. It affected my brain, and I've never felt quite so ill in my life. And it turned out that the apartment, which was close to the ocean, we get a little dusting of moisture every morning, and then the sun would come in through the windows and it would catch in the carpets and create a bloom of some sort. And it was extremely difficult. It was a miserable reality for me. So that's one of the reasons I'm concerned about the mold content down there. I have personal experience. It sounds to me, if one were to conclude and do kind of a summary of what we've covered so far, that quite honestly, there's a lot to be said that perhaps people are, well, first of all, they face a daunting challenge to try to figure out how to get back in there. And perhaps in some respects, this is my analysis, this isn't your analysis, but I guess if I were to summarize, I'd say perhaps people are going back a little too early. In other words, there hasn't been enough remediation to the soil and surfaces to allow people to go back there safely. And my concern is that 10 or 15 years from now, we could be hearing some real nightmare stories about the long-term effects of this. But that's just me. Why don't you give your analysis of the situation?
I have to say it makes me nervous to see all the children coming back into New Orleans, especially the young kids who are going to be tending to play in the dirt and then maybe put their hands in their mouths. And also kids are much more susceptible to allergens such as mold. So I do think that it's a little premature to bring kids back into the city, though I know some people don't have much choice. I also think that elderly folks, people with respiratory problems, really should also be careful about going back. I would certainly think twice if I fell into one of those categories. And healthy adults can certainly go back to begin to get their homes and their lives in order if they have proper protective equipment. And a lot of people, fortunately, are wearing appropriate respirators and gloves, et cetera, and I'm glad to see that now when I go down. Some of the areas in the city weren't flooded, and you can go to those areas now, and it almost is like the old days in New Orleans. You wouldn't think that the hurricane ever happened. You then go a few blocks to the areas that were flooded, and unfortunately, they're still devastated. And so it will be some time before the rest of that city is ready to be inhabited again.
What would you, if you could, you know, if you had unlimited funds, and, well, that's ridiculous. You don't have unlimited funds. No one does. That's part of our problem right now. What's a realistic remediation that you feel could accommodate people moving back in some sort of safer fashion? What could actually be done?
The testing so far has identified several significant hotspots for sediment contamination, and then some broader swaths of certain sections of the city that would need some cleanup. The thing that's kind of nice about cleaning things up right now is that there aren't a lot of people living there yet. It is possible still to go through with essentially a bulldozer and take off the top 2 inches, say, or 3 inches of soil or sediment and carry that off. And then replacing it with clean topsoil is actually feasible. In fact, that was done in some experimental projects before Hurricane Katrina for lead remediation. And they scooped soil up from the Bonnet Carey spillway on the Mississippi and brought it into neighborhoods, and it actually did a great job replacing the contaminated soil. So that's doable, and we know the areas that need to be cleaned up. There's no mystery about that. So, the testing's been done. Cleanup needs to happen. The Corps of Engineers needs to do it. Of course, there are a lot of things on their plate right now. The levees need to be done, too. Mm-hmm. But that's, I think, a very high priority. In terms of mold, that ends up being more of an issue for individual homeowners, where people need to know that they have to gut their homes and, rebuild the interiors. Lots of people are doing it, and I think that section of the cleanup is well underway.
Well, I think your solution of taking off the top 2 inches of soil seems to be an absolutely, it's a no-brainer. That is where the concentration is going to exist. If we wait too long, it'll just keep on penetrating down deeper and deeper into the soils. So that would seem to be the type of thing that people should just should get involved with. Now, in terms of your research and how it's being accepted by people who are controlling the